This program includes snippets from interviews we previously conducted in years past with three talents involved in the production of JFK: Academy Award-winning cinematographer Robert Richardson, producer A. Kitman Ho, and co-star Michael Rooker. The episode also includes highlights from three brand new, never-before-heard conversations we conducted with actress Sally Kirkland, author and assassination researcher Jim Mars, and Academy Award-winning editor Joe Hutching. To hear the uncut versions of these brand new interviews, including over 30 minutes of additional behind-the-scenes anecdotes and assassination theories, visit blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or moviegeeksunited.net.
In this case, they were bitterly criticizing the film even before anyone got to see it.
I started screaming and the tears started streaming down my face, and he said, God, I've never seen anyone do that so fast.
Would you say that that is the most challenging production that you've ever been involved in?
No, that isn't the most challenging. That was most very rewarding,
yeah.
And it is, I think, most interesting, I would say.
We would do things with 35 black and white and 35 color to hint at things that people are saying are real but may not necessarily be real.
You know, you're working with Oliver Stone at his premiere peak.
The challenge with the movie was to keep it moving and to never be confused. If you get confused, you zone out. And that was one thing that we never wanted the audience to feel, the least bit of confusion.
Truth is the most important value we have, because if the truth is not endured, if the government murders truth, if we cannot respect the hearts of these people, then this is not the country in which I was born in, and it's certainly not the country that I want to die in. Do not forget your dying king.
Three-time Academy Award winner Oliver Stone was a hot director in 1991, having come off a succession of intensely observed and highly passionate films that dared to have a point of view about America and its place in the world. Films like Platoon, Wall Street, and Born on the 4th of July. These films would mark the prelude for what would be his most incendiary work yet, JFK, a sprawling three-plus-hour epic that reignited one of the most traumatic events in American history, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Brilliantly melding multiple film formats and featuring an all-star cast to deliver some of the most interesting and colorful performances of their careers, JFK's power as an exercise in craft could not be denied, even by the assorted critics and journalists who had their knives out for it. In fact, no other film I can think of was targeted with such ferocity at such an early stage as this one. You couldn't pass a newsstand without the vitriolic headlines glaring back at you. One outlet even stole an early version of the script and based their criticisms on its outdated findings as the film was in the midst of production. Stone's screenplay was largely based upon the findings of New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, who brought the notion of conspiracy front and center into the public consciousness in the late 60s. As played by Kevin Costner, Garrison is the film's stabilizing force amidst the chaos of multiple storylines and a host of flamboyant and fascinating characters. He is our Jimmy Stewart in a world gone mad. It is through Garrison's journey that we uncover an endless well of inconsistencies in the Warren Commission's investigation of the assassination, which ultimately targeted Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone perpetrator of the century's most notorious murder. This was, in Stone's words, a counter-myth to the Warren Report. But that's certainly not all it is. Like all great movies, what JFK is about isn't all it's really about. Beyond the staggering level of craft, including one of the greatest works of film editing in the history of the medium, and its exploration of the most gripping murder mystery of our time, JFK speaks of the need for all American citizens to offer a personal and deep investment in the future of their country. This country is ours, the film says, and it's up to us to make sure we hold our leaders accountable and fight for the ideals we hold most dear. I first saw the film upon its initial release in 1991. I was 18 years old, which is a perfect age to discover a film like this, and it's made a profound impact on me that remains to this day. In many ways, Oliver Stone's JFK changed my life and my perception of the world, not because of the flashy whodunit aspects of the narrative, but because at its center, the film possesses a profound sense of idealism, right down to its marrow. Tonight, we look back at Oliver Stone's JFK with an astonishing group of talents who collaborated on bringing Mr. Stone's epic vision to the screen, including Jim Mars, Sally Kirkland, Joe Hutching, Robert Richardson, Michael Rooker, and A. Kitman Ho. We begin tonight with a snippet of conversation we conducted with producer A. Kitman Ho back in 2007. Here's what he had to say about the origins of the JFK project and what it's meant to him in the scope of his career. I have to ask you about two films in particular, because they're two films that I think absolutely rank among the finest American films ever, and they have really changed my life in a way.
Really? Wow.
And that's Born in the Fourth and JFK.
Wow.
Can you share any of the first memories that come to your mind about both of those productions?
Well, I mean, I remember that Oliver read the book, JFK, which is the Jim's story.
Yeah,
Jim Garrison, right?
Jim Garrison's story, and that was great. And we were doing, we were doing Wall Street. That's what it was. And then we were talking about it, and then we decided that we should, and then Tom, we went, and he had the same agent as Tom Cruise, which is Paul Wagner at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was interested, so we had to wait for Tom. And we did that picture. Yeah, we did that picture. What did we do it for? Born on the Fourth. I forgot who we did Born on the Fourth for.
Universal.
Oh, Universal, right. We did that at Universal, right. Oh, yeah. And then, but we had to wait for him. So that's why we did Talk Radio in Dallas, because we couldn't afford to shoot it in New York, so we shoot it in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And we did two pictures. We squeezed that in. And it was, the second part of, Oliver's trilogy, because I think that those were great pictures, because it's really Oliver, and it's really something he needs to get out of his system.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think is very important. And
and it seems, in terms of both of these films, it seems like passion just seeps out of every frame.
Absolutely.
You said, he had to make these.
Exactly.
And they're so incredibly personal to him.
Yeah, it is. And that's what Platoon was, too. Platoon was something that he really, was really part of his life, and he actually lived through that, and talking to him about it.
Yeah. But in terms of JFK, would you say that is the most challenging production that you've ever been involved in?
No, that isn't the most challenging. That was the most, very rewarding,
yeah.
And it is, I think, most interesting, I would say. Because because we use a lot of formats, totally a lot of different formats in film, and also then telling that story, because it could be a very boringly straight story,
right?
And being that the story right now it is a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think
What really strikes me about it is, first of all, I like I said, I think it's one of the great American films, but it was shot in 72 days, I read. And that same year, you guys did The Doors.
Yeah.
So it was like a back-to-back that just staggering.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the great thing about it is that at that time we basically built a team of people.
Uh-huh.
Like the cinematographer, which is Bob Richardson, and the designers and so on. So we had all these people, and all the people would go from one film to the other. So by the time we're in editorial, we have two editors who obviously, that we work together a lot. and they, you know, they, most of them won Academy Awards.
That's yeah.
how lucky they were. And and you know, so the teams just keep on going. So by the time, like, Oliver would write the structure of the thing, the movie, I would be scouting it, and then the team would go in and knowing exactly what we need, and we go from there and then. So that makes it easy, very easy for him to, you know, as a team, like, I understand what he needed, and
uh-huh.
and I basically prep it, and then the DP knows what he needed, the designer. So it's all, it was great communication. It was really actually making movies.
Jack was a pimp. He was a bag man for the Dallas mob. He used to run guns to Castro when he was still on our side. We almost had Castro with us, then we tried to whack him. Everybody's flipping sides all the time. It's funny games, man, funny games.
What about the mob, Dave? How do they figure in this?
The agency too, man. CIA and the mafia working together, trying to whack out the beer, mutual interest. They've been doing it for years. It's more than anything you could dream. Well, check out something called Mongoose, Operation Mongoose.
Mongoose?
Government, Pentagon stuff. Oh, what a deadly web we weave when we practice the deceit.
And who killed the president?
Oh, man, why don't you stop it? This is too big for you, you know that? This is... Who did the president? Who killed Kennedy? It's a mystery. It's a mystery wrapped in a riddle inside an enigma. The shooters don't even know. Don't you get it? I can't keep talking like this. You're going to kill me. I'm going to die.
In addition to Mr. Garrison's book On the Trail of the Assassins, JFK is also partially based upon the groundbreaking book by author Jim Mars titled Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy. Mr. Mars has made a name for himself as one of the leading researchers in the assassination conspiracy. In this segment of our interview with Mr. Mars, you'll hear him discuss anecdotes related to the shooting of the film. You can hear our unedited interview with Mr. Mars at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited.
My connection with Oliver Stone began about 2 months after the publication of my book, Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, which was in the fall of 1989, I believe. And I think basically what happened was is that Oliver Stone had already decided to do a movie on the Kennedy assassination, and I think that's because he had already done Platoon, which shows the American combat experience in Vietnam, and then Born on the 4th of July, which then showed the aftermath and what it was like on the civilian side during Vietnam. And I think he, being a Vietnam combat veteran, and he was intensely interested in why Vietnam, what led to all that, and why we do that. And I think that led him to the Kennedy assassination. So he had already decided to use Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans, as a protagonist to, because as Stone told me, one of the first times I ever met him was, he said, I want you to understand, I'm not making a documentary, I'm making a movie. So he wanted a storyline, and he was going to use Kevin...
Costner,
Costner, Kevin Costner, as Jim Garrison. The problem was, Garrison's book covered his perspective and the events of his prosecution of Clay Shaw in New Orleans, but it did not really get into the details of the assassination itself in Dealey Plaza. And my book, Crossfire, covered that in great detail with all the evidence and witnesses and theories and everything else. And so he had a former CIA station chief, John Stockwell, working for him. And Stockwell, as I understand later, that told him, hey, Jim Mars has a book out that covers all those details. And so the next thing I know, my agent had gotten a contact from Stone's people and wanted to know if the book was available as the basis for a movie. And, of course, we said yes, and that's how all that began.
Were you skeptical at all? Because obviously this is a big Hollywood studio movie, JFK. I mean,
right.
you wouldn't have thought that they would be brave enough to mount a film like this.
Well, yes, I had some trepidations. But here's the thing. I already had my contract. I already got my money. And so I was fully prepared to repudiate the movie if I thought they strayed too much from my conclusions and my beliefs about the truth behind the assassination. But interestingly enough, they didn't even just use the material in my book per se. He had a his own research team headed by a woman named Jane Rascuni, and they backtracked on my book, and they re-interviewed some of the same people I interviewed, and they looked at the same evidence I'd looked at, and interestingly enough, they came to the same conclusions.
Yeah.
And because it's just there, okay? Let me explain to you about the Kennedy assassination in a nutshell. It's a matter of just belief systems, okay? If you trust the government and believe what the government tells you, even though they've lied to us time after time after time, I mean, light in the end of the tunnel of Vietnam, no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, read my lips, no new taxes, the air quality's okay on Manhattan following 9/11. I mean, they only lie to you continually. But if you trust the government, then you trust the evidence they present against Lee Harvey Oswald, and it does appear on the surface that it's pretty damning, and therefore he must have done it all by himself. But if you don't trust the government and you question this evidence and you look closer, it all begins to fall apart, and you realize that there's something else going on, and this is the key to the assassination. Anyone could have killed Kennedy. KGB agents, CIA assassins, mafia hitmen, Castro agents, and yes, even the proverbial lone nut. Okay, so anyone could have killed him, but who had the power to cover it up and to block any meaningful investigation and to fabricate evidence, destroy evidence, and alter evidence and suppress evidence and intimidate witnesses? Okay, only officials high in the federal government of the United States, and this is the key to the whole thing. This is what transformed what was then legally only another Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat, and that is the truth. And once you understand that, then everything kind of falls into place. It's like, you know, why is it still so controversial after 50 years? That's because nobody wants to admit to the coup of 1963.
And in that coup, in your opinion, what part, if any, did Oswald play?
He was a dupe, a patsy, just as he said he was. I think there's sufficient evidence to certainly raise reasonable doubt as to whether he even fired a rifle that day. Now, let me make this clear. I'm not saying Oswald was some innocent off the street. He was mixed up in the whole thing, but there is pretty overwhelming evidence that he was connected to U.S. intelligence, originally as through the Office of Naval Intelligence, and keep in mind the Marines are a branch of the Navy Department, picked up, sent on an intelligence mission to Russia, and then picked up as a CIA operative. There has been a CIA paymaster who testified to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that he actually remembered cutting checks from the CIA to Oswald long before the assassination. There's even an intriguing warning from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover in 1960. This is 3 years before the assassination, and he sent a memo to the Security Division of the State Department warning that an imposter might be using Lee Harvey Oswald's passport and seeking information. Now, that's amazing, because we were told at the time and basically throughout the years that nobody in the government knew much about Oswald. They didn't know him. They didn't know exactly what was going on. He was just kind of a loner. Nobody knew anything about him. And here shows none other than J. Edgar Hoover personally knew the name Lee Harvey Oswald 3 years before the assassination and suspected someone was impersonating him. It's just amazing. And so all of this adds up to the coup of 1963.
You know, Oswald, they wanted us to think of him as, like you said, the lone nut, just a frustrated loner. But his is really one of the most fascinating stories in American history. When you go down that wormhole, I mean, Oswald was was much more than just your average lone nut out there with a
rifle. Right. When at the time of his death, he had just turned 24. So basically, you know, he was basically 23 years old. You know, what a young guy. And yet, in the year or two prior to the incident in Dallas, he was in contact with no less than 9 FBI agents. I ask you in your audience, how many FBI agents have you come into contact with over the past year or so?
Yeah. So just back to the movie very quickly. When you were... It was based upon your book in part, and you were also a consultant on the film, so I would imagine you were present for a lot of the shooting of the film. Were you present for the Dealey Plaza recreation?
Yes. Yes, I was. In fact, I had a role. They asked me if I wanted a part, and I said, well, I'm not that interested in a part. I said, but I would like to be on hand when you run the motorcade again, because having studied all these years, that would really be a thrill to watch it all be reenacted. And so I shaved off my beard, and they put a toupee on me and some kind of outfit, and I was supposed to be Joseph Miltier, who was a right-winger here in Florida who had been tape-recorded by police several weeks ahead of time saying that Kennedy was going to be killed when he went to Dallas by sniper with a high-powered rifle. So I was there in the crowd along Houston Street when they ran the motorcade. And that was pretty interesting for me to watch it all, and having studied it at length as I have, and then watching it transpire in front of me. And while I'm there, I'll tell you about an incident that you probably hadn't heard about. But it kind of, in a spiritual way, tells me that I think there was probably somebody looking out for Stone and his movie. At one point, I was standing on the south curb of Elm Street and looking towards the school book depository in the intersection there at Houston and Elm. Moments before, a whole crowd of extras representing the crowd that day had been lined up all the way across the street, because the street had been blocked off both then and at the recreation. And they had been curbing all through Houston Street there. But the day was hot, and they called a break and called cut, and all these extras had moved out of the street, which was in direct sunlight, and were all standing over in the shadow of the Texas School Book Depository to get out of the direct sunlight. Meanwhile, the sixth floor museum, which claims that they try to make no particular position on the assassination, and yet they plexiglassed off the sixth floor window and put the little boxes there and left the window half open, and, you know, it just screams out, here's where the assassin was. And they wouldn't even let Stone film from that window. And I'll tell you the reason for that is because if you go and get in that window, which I have been there before they put the museum in, you cannot get a direct line of sight into the street where Kennedy was first shot because of an intervening tree. There's a live oak tree that's right there in between, and that causes a big problem. And, of course, they don't want people to see this because it contradicts the official version. And so they wouldn't let Stone film from the sixth floor window. But they allowed him to go to the seventh floor window, which was a really tall, big, tall plate glass window. And so I'm standing there watching this, and I look up, and there are on the seventh floor, and they're messing around at that window getting ready to shoot. Well, somebody must have bumped it or something, because all of a sudden this huge plate glass pops out of the window and starts falling down directly towards this crowd of extras standing there on the street corner. And I'm sitting there, and in my mind I'm flashing, this is horrendous. It's going to hit all those people, and it's going to shatter in a million pieces, and you're going to have all these people cut and maybe even killed. And just as I'm thinking that, a gust of wind came along and caught this pane of glass, and it kind of slid sideways and crashed into the middle of the street where they had just vacated and smashed into a million pieces. And everybody just kind of went, what was that, you know? And then people rushed out and began sweeping up the glass, and everything just went on, and I'm not sure that anybody even realized what kind of tragedy had just been averted. I think some of the people standing there below did not even realize what exactly had happened there. Isn't that an amazing story?
Yeah, that was that could definitely be construed as a sign. Tell me about what you were aware of in terms of the controversy surrounding this film and the efforts to kind of thwart the film before it even started shooting. I mean, this was unprecedented.
Well, here's the thing. I'm as a 50-year journalist, I try to maintain some objectivity, and so I certainly have no problem with dissenters and critics and people who want to say, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, and you know. But when I saw the high level of attack that took place on Stone's film, even before it was shown, I mean, any piece of art, whether it's a film or a statue or a painting or anything, you should at least let them perform and see the results and then criticize it, right? In this case, they were bitterly criticizing the film even before anyone got to see it. There was someone purloined an early version of the script, like script number 2 or something like that, and passed it to someone in the media who got it to some of the national media attack dogs. And they were raising Cain about this early version of a script. Well, I can tell you, because I traveled to Dallas and would sit up in the Stoneley Hotel and go over the script, okay, and make notations and suggestions and criticisms and stuff. They ended up with, I think, the final shooting script was like script number 12. So they're attacking the movie on script draft number 2. And it wasn't even the final version. So that really told me that there was a conscious effort to try to denigrate this film even before anyone got to see it, which certainly tells me that there's an agenda there. This isn't just an issue of criticizing Stone and his work. This is an issue of trying to baffle and befuddle the public and keep them from paying any good attention to the film, which, by the way, was indeed a movie. So it's not 100% ground truth, but I'm here to tell you that the movie JFK is the closest we've come to hearing the truth about the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
For example, I'm always being asked about, well, who was Mr. X, the person that Kevin Costner, as Jim Garrison, goes to Washington to meet, and he's some sort of insider, and he lays out all of the context in which the assassination took place. All right, the explanation for who was Mr. X basically was Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was a liaison officer between the Pentagon and the CIA, and as such, he was privy to information concerning both of those entities. And yet, being a Pentagon officer, he had not signed the secrecy oaths that CIA officers are required to sign, and therefore he was able to actually talk and say what was going on. And Jim Garrison indeed met with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, but this was only years after the prosecution of Clay Shaw. It did not happen within the time frame of the movie. And so I think Stone quite correctly knew that if he identified the man that Kevin Costner met with as Colonel Prouty, he would be met with the debunkers who would say, well, that didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen at that time, and Stone's just making stuff up. So what he did was, actually, Jim Garrison did go to Washington, and he did meet with a military intelligence officer named Richard Case Nagel. And Nagel told him some information, inside information, about the assassination. So what happened here was Stone combined those two characters.
Well, I never thought things were the same after that. Vietnam started for real. There was an era of, I don't know, make-believe in the Pentagon and CIA. Those of us who'd been in secret ops since the beginning knew the Warren Commission was fiction. But there was something deeper, uglier. I knew Alan Dulles very well. I'd briefed him many a time in his house. But for the life of me, I still can't figure out why he was appointed to investigate Kennedy's death, the man who had fired him. Dulles, by the way, was General Wife, benefactor. I got out in 64, resigned my commission.
I never realized Kennedy was so dangerous to the establishment. Is that Warren?
Well, that's a real question, isn't it? Why? The how and the who is just scenery for the public. Oswald, Ruby, Cuba, the Mafia. Keeps them guessing like some kind of parlor game, prevents them from asking the most important question, why? Why was Kennedy killed? Who benefited? Who has the power to cover it up?
I would imagine that you felt a certain kinship towards Jim Garrison. I mean, you guys were on the same journey and making lots of headway. I mean, did you have a lot of interaction with Mr. Garrison through the years?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot, but yes, I had met with him and interviewed him prior to even the movie deal going down. And I'd had lunch with him in New Orleans, and I found him to be a highly articulate and educated person and a very fascinating background. A lot of people don't realize that he had been a forward artillery observer in World War II, flying a little plane, which is a very hazardous job because they'd shoot you down if they could. And then after the war, he joined the FBI. And a lot of people don't understand that he was an FBI agent for a while. Then he went on and got into politics and ran and was elected district attorney there in New Orleans, and in fact had earned some ire among the city fathers for his trying to clean up the judicial system and trying to make things a little better there. Now, he's been criticized because they said that he went soft on organized crime. Well, being district attorney of New Orleans, I would think would be pretty similar to being district attorney of Las Vegas, okay? The mob's there, the mafia's there. It's a fact of life, and you just have to deal with it, as you can. But that doesn't mean that he was in the mafia's pocket. In fact, I asked him point blank about that at one point. I said, they criticize you for talking about the CIA and the FBI, but you don't hammer on the mafia. And his explanation was that he believed that there was mafia involvement in the assassination. He said, and I agree with him, that they did not have the power to orchestrate something like this on their own, and certainly not the power to cover it up and prevent any future prosecutions against organized crime for assassinating the President of the United States. And he said, therefore, I'm not that interested in the mafia. I want to know who was behind it.
I've been watching, obviously it's the 50th anniversary of the assassination, so there's a lot of television programming going on right now, and I've been watching a lot of it. And it feels to me, even though I'm sure the American public, through a vast majority, still believe in a conspiracy, it seems to me that the tide is starting to slowly turn to the lone gunman theory again in all of this stuff that I'm reading and watching on television. Do you sense that tide?
I absolutely do, and it's very simple. The powers that be, which are in power thanks to the coup of 1963, are trying to indoctrinate or at least confuse a whole new generation of Americans. You see, the cover-up in the Kennedy assassination has never been what we traditionally think of as a cover-up, a lack of evidence and information. The cover-up has been quite the opposite. It's been obfuscation, charge and countercharge, claim and counterclaim, theory versus another theory versus other theories, and they have confused the issue to the point where, as you point out, and it's obviously true, that 9 out of 10 Americans now believe that there was some sort of conspiracy to kill Kennedy, but everybody's confused and divided and fighting with each other over exactly which conspiracy it was, and that is the cover-up, because as long as the public is confused and conflicted, nothing gets done about it. And then you have to also understand that, you know, I am constantly asked, and have been for years, will we ever know the truth about the Kennedy assassination? And I'm here to tell you, yes, we know the truth right now. It's just that most people do not want to face it. And what I mean is that, yes, we had a national coup d'etat.
One of the most impressive aspects of JFK is its look, starting with the masterful cinematography from Robert Richardson, who combined multiple film formats to create an extremely vivid portrait of American history. We conducted a lengthy interview with Mr. Richardson back in 2011. Here's what he had to say about his work on JFK during that conversation.
Very early on, we talked about the Zapruder material. And from the Zapruder material, we moved out of that 8mm. And we then captured things based upon 8mm reproductions, 16mm reproductions, black and white color. It was extremely mapped out, and we would do things with 35 black and white and 35 color to hint at things that people are saying are real but may not necessarily be real. The format changes only work in cinema on a large screen. If you watch it on a television now, you can't feel the alteration in texture, which was vital.
The first shot rings out, sounding like a backfire. It misses the car completely. Frame 161, Kennedy stops waving as he hears something. Connie's head turns slightly to the right. Frame 193, the second shot hits Kennedy in the throat from the front. Frame 225, the president emerging from behind the road sign. You can see that he's obviously been hit, raising his arms to his throat. The third shot, frame 232, hits Kennedy in the back, pulling him downward and forward. Conley, you will notice, shows no signs at all of being hit. He is visibly holding his Stetson, which is impossible if his wrist has been shattered. Conley is turning here now. Frame 238, the fourth shot. It misses Kennedy and takes Conley in the back. This is the shot that proves there were two rivals. Conley yells out, "My God, they're going to kill us all." Somewhere around this time now, another shot that misses the car completely strikes James Page down by the underpass. The car breaks. The sixth and fatal shot, frame 313, takes Kennedy in the head from the front. This is the key shot. The president going back and to his left. Shot from the front and right. Totally inconsistent with the shot from the depository. Again. Back to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left.
I think that in terms of that film, we rarely deviated from what we set up as a criteria for how to choose a format. That's very different than what we achieved in Natural Born Killers. But before we even get there, I think that one thing that I need to note for you is that there was an editor. The editor is Hank Corwin. Hank I had worked with on commercials. He's a very aggressive individual. I introduced him to Oliver. He's not listed as an editor. But the majority of those sequences, such as the opening, all that material, it is Hank. Hank's giving you these format changes, too, in a very different way. And you can see his work multiply into a pretty fascinating contribution in Natural Born Killers. He's also recently worked with Malick on Tree of Life and Malick on, the film prior, Beginnings. Anyway, so his work is fundamental because I knew Hank, and because I knew Hank so intimately, I knew where we were going to be placing certain things and how he would work best with those formats.
Mr. Richardson won an Academy Award for his work as cinematographer on the film JFK. The team of editors from JFK also took home Academy Awards, and that team was led by Joe Hutching. Here are some highlights from our conversation with Joe about his extraordinary contributions to the film. You can hear his entire unedited interview at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. You first started with Oliver Stone on Wall Street, right?
That's true. Yes, that's correct. But I had been editing on my own for years. It's just I hadn't had a break. I'd been editing student films and anything I could get my hands on, and also assisting. But I never wanted to assist, so I always edited, even without pay.
When you started working under Mr. Stone, what distinguished him in your eyes?
That he would listen to anyone. That you didn't have to go up to the traditional. He was very untraditional in how he hired editors. And so the fact that by the next picture I had a front credit was kind of astonishing. But I didn't know that at the time. But he ran a very non-traditional cutting room, and that he did not want to hear from. It was a very guarded place where we could share ideas.
But it seems to me that Mr. Stone was kind of redefining his style of shooting from film to film, and by the time we get to JFK, it was very kind of aggressively experimental. So I'm curious to know, before you started cutting, were you in on the how much you were in on the conversation of the direction he was taking this?
No, I was not. I was unaware of it. I knew that they were going to. As soon as we started shooting, they had multiple formats. And so we started shooting in Dallas on April 15th. And at that time, we had just finished The Doors. And The Doors was a nonlinear film, and that we cut it it was the first digital nonlinear film for editing, because we used the Edit Droid on that, which was partially financed by George Lucas. And so he gave us free laser discs, or he paid for the transfer of the laser discs on The Doors so that we could use it in return for Oliver giving it a plug, giving it a good word. So it turned out it was a buggy system. It was we were beta testing it, but I still loved it immediately because it was, I thought that would be the future, some kind of electronic editing. And then when we got to JFK, which was the next year, we did not have the budget to transfer everything to Laserdisc, and George Lucas wasn't going to pay for another film to do that. And the transfer process from film to Laserdisc was very expensive, so we couldn't afford that. So we are in Dallas. I have my 35-millimeter flatbed film editing equipment, which were chems, called chems, from Germany. And then we started getting in Super 8, Straight 8, 16-millimeter, and then, of course, all the stock footage. And I couldn't edit those on a chem because it's just 35 millimeters. And so one option was to transfer everything to have it telecined. They would transfer it from whatever format it was on to 35 millimeter. Again, incredibly expensive. So as the footage is starting to pile up, the three editors, myself, Pietro Scalia, and Hank Corwin, were scratching our heads going, what are we going to do? How can we edit this when we don't have anything to edit on? And I had done a lot, because I had done student films for years at AFI, I said, let's try 3/4-inch linear videotape, because time was running out. And there really wasn't anything else. Avid didn't exist. Lightworks didn't exist. And Metadroid was an impossibility. So we transferred everything to 3/4-inch videotape and began editing on that, which is a very brutal way to edit, I must say, because it is linear, and it's ugly, and it's slow. And so, in other words, if you have linear, meaning if you have two shots in a row and you want to add a shot in the middle, it's very easy to do that with film because you just put it in. And it's very easy on an Avid because you insert it, and it's nothing. It's nonlinear. It'll just go right in. But with the 3/4-inch linear, you would have to bump down a generation in order to add a shot. It was a very bad way to do it, but it was the only logical choice we had. In a way, it was also a great way to do it because the machine made mistakes all the time. It was very imperfect, and sometimes those mistakes turned into happy accidents, and we could claim authorship of some weird transition that we'd never thought of that just happened by some electronic ghost. But, of course, that didn't happen very often. I wish it had happened a lot more. Most of it, 99.9% of it was just very, very hard work.
Even so, if I'm correct in the timing of this, I mean, the timing between shooting the film and delivering the final print was very short, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. We started shooting April 15th, 1991, and we were in the theaters on December 20th.
Oh.
That's 8 months. And so the schedule was brutal. We basically had almost no days off. And that's tough, especially the last few months when you're so tired. And we were working 16-hour days easily, sometimes more, 7 days a week. And we moved one of our assistants up to an editor position. So there were a lot of people working on it. The process of later going from this weird 3/4-inch tape that had time codes all over it, so you would know where it originated from, filmically. We had to bring in a crew of people to actually decipher what the codes meant and then build the actual film that they shot to match it. And at one point, I had 25 people working under me in an editing room. That included all the editors and the assistants and apprentices. I think the most I've had in the past is like 6 or 7. So having 25 people under me was pretty amazing. And I didn't even, like some of the people I never even met because they were in distant rooms just building stuff. And we were so busy. It was a huge task.
But one of the things that impresses me most about it is in JFK you have these hundreds of moving parts, but you never lose sight of the central journey, the journey of the central character of Jim Garrison. What was it a challenge to maintain that in the midst of all of this chaos going around his personal journey?
Yes. The script was, I can't remember how many pages it was, but it was very long. I mean, look, it's a three-hour and eight-minute movie, and that's a long script. The script was very dense, and it was hard for me to read because it was very technical. It was very detailed, and I found at times it was just boring. And the challenge with the movie was to keep it moving and to never be confused, because it would be, if you get confused, you zone out. And that was one thing that we never wanted the audience to feel the least bit of confusion. There are some repetitious moments in JFK, but they're only to remind you of where you are in the story and who is who. They were done for that reason. All other bits of repetition were eliminated so that the story would move forward. But I think with the way it was shot and the way we edited it to keep it fresh and to keep it lively instead of static, that helped you through this 3-hour and 8-minute journey of, you know, an exploration into an assassination.
Yeah, because there's so much information being delivered and thrown at you in these scenes. I mean, I'm thinking of the dinner table scene at the restaurant where they're deconstructing Oswald's history.
When he's arrested, Marina buries him with the public. Her description of him is that of a psychotic and violent man.
I have too much facts, and facts tell me that Lee shot Kennedy.
After they kept her locked away for 2 months surrounded by federal people and fearing she'd be deported back to Russia, right? The poor woman was probably suffering from nervous exhaustion. They taught her how to answer. And when they think she's ready, they buy new dresses, polish her appearance, and wheel her out on cue.
I would like to thank the Warren Commission.
Oswald was no angel, that's clear. But who was he?
I'm lost, boss. What are we saying here? We're saying that when Oswald went to Russia, he was not a real defector. That he was an intelligence agent on some kind of mission for our government and remained one until the day he died. That's what we're saying.
Therefore, because Oswald pulled the trigger, the intelligence community murdered their own commander-in-chief. Is that what you're saying?
I'll go you one better, Bill. Maybe Oswald didn't even pull the trigger. Nitrate tests indicate he hadn't even fired a rifle on November 22nd. And on top of that, they didn't even bother to see if the rifle had been fired that day.
He had his palm print on the weapon.
Well, it went to the FBI, Bill. The FBI didn't find a goddamn thing. It comes back a week later, and one guy in the Dallas Police Department suddenly finds a palm print. For all we know, it could have been taken off Oswald in the morgue. There's no chain of evidence.
Yeah, I never could figure out why this guy orders a traceable weapon to this post office box when he can go into any store in Texas, give a phony name, and walk out with a rifle which can never be traced.
To frame him, obviously.
There's a lot of smoke there. But there's some fire.
We're talking about our government here.
No, we're talking about a crime, Bill, pure and simple. Y'all got to start thinking on a different level like the CIA does. Now, we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white. Just maybe Oswald is exactly what he said he was. A patsy.
If you just read it from the script, you might as well be a lecturer with a PowerPoint presentation. It could be very dry. That is what most amazes me about it, is that it fires your visual imagination so much as an audience.
We had a great asset on that movie, and that was Hank Corwin, who had come out of commercials, and it was the first thing he'd worked on. And Hank is a very prolific and very incredibly well-respected commercial editor, and so he had a lot of very unusual ideas that we were completely open to, and so his idea of cutting the using that X-Acto knife, cutting around and cutting the picture of Oswald for the cover of Life magazine was done by Hank, and I thought it was just brilliant. He was a great part of that crew, and so I think we all inspired each other. Hank certainly inspired me, as did Pietro, who was just learning, basically, at that point. It was his first job as a picture editor. And we all worked together, although we certainly had clashing moments. But I think because the movie itself is so much about conflict, I think that if there was any conflict in the editing, it worked in terms of just being a part of that motif of conflict that ran throughout the mm-hmm. film, conflict of stories, it's a Rashomon story. And so everyone had a different take on it. And then we put those together. Amazingly, scenes very cut very, very easily. I think Oliver was at the height of his game during that. And all the footage just was not, I mean, it was difficult because we were working so long and we had such a brutal deadline, but the actual footage itself was very well done and just seemed to go together effortlessly. Although we did work hard and on, some scenes were harder than others and we did a little bit of restructuring. But all in all, it was very fun to cut.
And there's something that fascinates me about a technique that Mr. Stone uses in his movies, and I think it pops up most prominently and earliest in JFK, which is the kind of subliminal cuts. I'm not sure how else to express it, but where an actor, where you'll cut to an actor or an event that very subliminally expresses what's going on in the main scene.
We tried to use that throughout the movie, honestly, when we were working out, I'd never seen a movie like that. When I would watch it, I'd go, you know what, this is original. And I just thought, I wonder if people will like it or so connect with it. I connected with it, but, you know, I was so close to it. But those moments were peppered throughout the film and done intentionally and really just done for an atmospheric or reflective quality to bring you closer to that you know, feeling that you would get, that you wouldn't just get from somebody from straight dialogue. It becomes poetry, in a sense, I guess,
mm-hmm.
instead of just talk.
I can recall archival footage very prominently in the opening of the film, mm-hmm. obviously when they're you're setting up the event. But it becomes harder and harder to distinguish in the course of the film what is a recreation and what is perhaps archival footage outside of the Donald Sutherland scene, I suppose. Tell me the challenges of knowing when and how much archival footage to use.
It's really a gut thing, but they, for instance, when they shot Ruby, when Ruby shot Oswald, that was, of course, we had the film from the real shooting, which is very famous, and they also recreated it with the characters, with Gary Oldman and with Brian Doyle Murray, played Jack Ruby. And so when I cut that together, I did it in a way to use both. And obviously, because you don't want to cut from, you know, you've already established this character, which is Brian Doyle Murray and Gary Oldman as Lee Harvey Oswald. So you can't just cut to the fake one. So in some of those cases, I did use quite a bit of the actual assassination, but I intercut it. You can't use very much, but it's great, and it was so fun to blur the lines between the actual assassination, you know, the killing and the fake one. And I really those were some of the things I enjoyed the most, intercutting, you know, Zapruder with film that we recreated in the, you know, in Dealey Plaza and throughout the film. It was very fun to use it. And your taste dictates how much to use. You want it to look real. You want it to have maximum impact. So if something looks at all fake, you don't use it. Or if you just go, oh, that doesn't quite work, you just take it out. You try something else. But in all cases, if we had something that where there was real footage and they recreated it, we absolutely wanted to use that in every case. Just to because part of you has seen that film and you know it's real, and then when you see it cut in, it just adds a dynamism to the film, which it wouldn't have if it was just one or the other. Bob handed out cameras to so many people. So there was a lot of people had Super 8 cameras that day, the recreation day. And so, you know, that was just a mind-boggling amount of footage just to go through. Because a lot of the, you know, some of the people were amateurs, but it didn't matter. I just looked at all the footage as, is this good? Is this good? And then, of course, Bob was there, too, with, you know, with 16, 35, all different, just, you know, black and white color. It was wild. And, you know, if you look at the movie, too, you can see that the aspect ratio is changing constantly, meaning that the sides that, you know, sometimes there's black bars on the sides mm-hmm. and sometimes there aren't. And we thought about that when we were doing that. Is that going to bother anyone? And I just felt strongly that no one was going to care and no one would see that. Like, if you just did it, just go with it. And if you follow the dialogue, the thread of the story, you're not really going to notice that the sides move, you know, that there's black bars. And I don't think anyone notices that ago, and I didn't even notice it. I didn't think about it.
You know, but we're talking about the archival, and for a lot of us, I mean, me included, this was the first time we saw the Zapruder film in full, mainly right. the kill shot, which is mm-hmm. so exceptionally shocking. And it's repeated time and time again back and to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to have been intentional from the get-go, because this was the kind of the crux of the case for conspiracy in a way.
There again, a little bit of repetition, but done in a great way. You know, looking at the film, the Zapruder film, and I think we finally got it. We got everything. I can't remember, but I think we were the first people to have the whole thing and had it steadied and have every frame, because I think the FBI had cut it up, or the police department had cut it up to analyze it. Anyway, they restored it, so we had the entire thing. And even though I saw it countless times over and over, backwards and forwards, every time that came on, it just devastating to see for me, who... You know, and I remember that day because I was 9. I was in fourth grade when it happened. And the teacher came, we were in class, and the principal came in and whispered something to our teacher. And she sat down and put her head down and started crying. And then the principal said there'll be an announcement in a half an hour in the lunch court. So I think everyone who was, you know, of a age where you can remember anything remembers that day. And so when the movie was especially powerful for me because it was a part of my life.
Yeah. Did you get a sense from a lot of the people that you were working with that this did feel like sacred ground that you guys were covering?
Yes. I felt that myself. I don't know how much other people felt about it, but I definitely felt that. And was excited to work on it. I think, like a lot of people, I remember the event, and my grandparents saw Oswald being assassinated by Ruby live on television. And then when the Warren Report came out, they said, lone killer, you know, a guy who is a nut. And I think we all pretty much, I was like everybody else, I pretty much accepted, well, you know, they've done it. There was no reason to distrust the government at that moment, and I think I accepted along with everyone else and hadn't really thought about it until Oliver sent me the script, and I started thinking about it. I thought, wow, I didn't know any of this stuff. And I read a few books and became very interested in it, and was very happy that I could work on something like that. That made a difference. It was hugely controversial.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I think about the controversy surrounding the film even before it started shooting. I mean, it was unparalleled, the media scrutiny against the film. But then when it finally opened and it was successful, I mean, audiences eventually flocked to it. I think it kind of spoke to... The assassination was still and is still kind of an open wound, and I think people were anxious
Absolutely.
To engage with it. So, but this was something that you nurtured and you cared deeply about, as we just said. So when it finally was released, and amidst all the criticism, it found success with audiences. That must have felt incredibly gratifying for you.
Incredibly gratifying. Well, I had no idea that people were going to talk about the editing so much. When we're working on it, we're not thinking about, you're just thinking about getting the job done, and hopefully people will understand it and just going, oh my God, it's 3 hours. Is anyone really going to watch this? And it was amazing how people loved it and just said, wow, I can't believe I watched a 3-hour movie and was riveted the whole time. And that to me was that was part of the success of the editing, was that we were able to make that an involving film that is, you know, it's not sexy. It's horror show stuff. And then to make a 3-hour movie of that was a challenge. and to make it compelling for the entire time. So and then when it came out, it was just gratifying. The fact that it did so well in terms of awards and stuff was that was really fun. But when we were working on it, we never were thinking about that. It was just let's just make this as good as we can and get the job done. But it was really I was stunned by the reception of it, and I was also stunned by some of the I remember I talked to this one guy. I was looking. It was when I was working on the movie, and I called up. I can't remember. He's a famous filmmaker, and he'd done. Geez, I wish I could remember what this is, Jamie. But he was a guy who made a fortune in Hollywood in television, and he did like a movie called. It was a short documentary about how Oswald acted alone or something, and I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, I called this guy. I got him on the phone. I said, "Hey." Well, you know, my name is Joe Hutching. I'm editing this movie called JFK, and I wanted to know if you had any access to footage or something. And he said, "You're working on that Oliver Stone film?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, you can tell him to go fuck himself and fuck you too." And he hung up on me. And I went, "Wow, that was when I first got, wow, I guess not everyone believed that there might have been other shooters." And it was almost like a, then I started to, I talked to people that were like my doctor at the time, my general practitioner. I went and see him, and he had seen JFK, and he wanted to lecture me about it, about how that was bullshit. But, it's Oliver Stone is a conspiracy theorist, and it was just like, wow, I didn't know. It really touched a nerve in some people. And I was surprised at that.
And yeah, I would imagine that's better than the alternative, which is indifference.
No one saw your movie.
Yeah.
No one cared. They're like, "What did you work on?" No, I never heard of it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the opposite. I wanted to. One of your things was to share any personal experiences in the film, and I think I have a couple of good ones. So one day. While we were still in Dallas, so it's the first month of shooting, and they were shooting they were going to shoot Jack Ruby's club. Jack Ruby owned a strip club where Oswald used to go and hang out. I mean, that's just weird in itself, right? It's just, there's so many weird things about that movie. Anyway, so Oliver came into my editing room and said, "Hey, Joe, this woman, Beverly Oliver, was a stripper at Jack Ruby's club, and she was the babushka lady. She was on the middle lawn, kind of near Gene Hill, facing the grassy knoll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were sort of like as Kennedy's car came down the street where he got shot. They were right there. They were like some of the closest people to Kennedy." So anyway, he said, so Beverly Oliver used to be a stripper. You know, she was a dancer at Jack Ruby's club, and she wants to come in and play you some music. She's going to play you some music for the so we know what they played on that day, at that time in Jack Ruby's club. So I said, oh, okay. So in my office in Dallas, and I was actually working on that scene where the part of the assassination scene in the plaza, in Dealey Plaza, and there's a knock at my door, and in comes this woman who was attractive and voluptuous, but quite a bit older than me. I was a fairly young man at the time, and she said. And she had a little boombox, a little cassette player with it. And she said, can I play this music for you? And I said, oh, sure. So, oddly enough, she was on her the real Beverly Oliver was on my screen, on my editing machine. And so, she turned on the cassette, and it was a song called Apple Blossom, Pink, Cherry Blossom, White. I can't remember the name of it. It's a standard. Anyway, she turned it on, and then she was wearing a very tight-fitting outfit. I knew she'd been very hot at one point in her life. Although she seemed ancient to me, although she was, I think she was 50, but I don't know, at the time that seemed really old. And she started dancing in my editing room. And you know that thing when dancers, they twirl, their head like stays in the same spot in their body, and they're looking at you, and then their body whips around, and then their head follows. It was one of those things. She started dancing. She started doing this erotic dance in my editing room in Dallas. That was weird. That was a moment I thought, I'll never forget this. And then she, you know, she was very nice, and then she packed up her thing, and I said, so, Miss Oliver, when you were there, what did you see? And she said, and she told me that she had seen the shot, had seen a flash from above the picket fence and smoke. And when I talked to Jean Hill later, who I also met, who was there, who was next to her on the lawn, she said the same thing. Flashes above the picket fence and smoke. I mean, these are people that told me to my face that were there and had no reason to lie. That was interesting. Another story was kind of, I was in my editing room at Lantana in Los Angeles, and Ann Richards, the governor of Texas, came to visit us. And Oliver Stone said, I want to show Ann some of the footage. Why don't you pick out like half an hour or something and just show it to her. So a couple of weeks before then, just by coincidence, one of my assistants and I had decided to make a T-shirt a JFK T-shirt, kind of a crew T-shirt, and we used Gary Oldman's picture from the movie, a still where he had been hit and his eye was bloody, and the caption said, "I'm just a patsy, JFK," you know, and Oliver Stone film or something like that. Anyway, so I had had those made up. So when Ann came in to see the movie, after she saw it, I gave her a, and it was just me and Ann watching the movie, and she was then the governor of Texas. It was pretty wild. And when she was done, she really liked the section I sent her, that I showed her, and I gave her a JFK T-shirt that I designed, and in front of me, she didn't get a dress, she just put it on over her clothes, and she wore it out, and she walked out to her car with the JFK T-shirt on, which I thought was amazing. During the shooting of the film, I thought that, because so many people had died during the investigation of the assassination, and so many shenanigans had happened to people that were on trial or being investigated for various reasons surrounding the assassination, I kept thinking, because we were in New Orleans, which is kind of an intelligence seat of power, I kept thinking I'd come into my editing room and everything would be gone. Or somehow there'd be, you know what happened? All the negative burned down. The negative burned in a fire or something. I kept thinking something horrible would happen, but nothing ever did.
JFK features one of the great all-star casts in the history of cinema. Talents like Kevin Costner, Walter Matthau, Jack Lemmon, Ed Asner, Joe Pesci, Donald Sutherland. Tonight, we're pleased to bring you insights from two of those terrific ensemble actors. First, Michael Rooker, whom we first spoke to several years ago. And here's what he had to say about his experiences of working with Oliver Stone.
It was quite the experience, really. I mean, you're working with Oliver Stone, probably Oliver Stone at his premier peak, you know. He was such a hot director at the time, and he would have been able to do anything he wanted to do, you know, and he chose this story, and I thought he did quite a good job with making this movie. I
right.
mean, and we were he was a very intriguing director, you know. He gave general direction, and then he'd like leave, and he'd be in a little booth with the video camera playback somewhere. No one knew where. So it was down
right.
the hall, the next floor, wherever he was, who knows. And he just let us go at it, you know. He liked that, and he loved seeing mistakes. He
mm-hmm.
loved seeing people get in there and maybe forgetting their lines and having the ad lib, and or getting in there and maybe the door doesn't open, or
yes.
you gotta pull it a little extra hard, or maybe you trip on something over the floorboard or something like that. I mean, he loved that kind of stuff.
Right.
But then again, he could be quite specific. If you weren't giving him what he wanted, he would just get down on your ass big time. Oh my gosh.
I could see that.
I can definitely see that.
Yeah, and he had no qualms at all about doing it either. So in front of anyone. I mean, if you're there and you're not putting out, he'd tell you right into your face, and you know, you could have 15 people around you. He didn't really care.
Academy Award nominated actress Sally Kirkland might have had a small role in JFK as the character of Rose Shirami, but she made an indelible impression. Her few highly emotional moments actually set off the whole narrative of the film from the very beginning. Here are a few highlights of what she had to say about working on the film. You can hear her complete unedited interview at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited. I understand at the beginning that your character wasn't even in the script.
In the script, right. Yeah, I called Oliver and I said that my mother had known JFK and Jackie, and she was fashion editor of Life at the time and kept putting Jackie O on the cover as a fashion icon, and that I had to be in the movie. And he said, well, there was no part. Everything was cast. And I said, but you're Oliver Stone. You'll think of something. And he said, well, okay, give me a few days. And he called me back, and he said something like there were five women who were assassinated because they knew too much about, you know, the intent to kill Kennedy, and would I be willing to come in and improvise all of them? And I said sure. And I believe the ones I remember was that there was a doctor, so I had on like a white suit, and Dorothy Kilgallen, the talk show host. And Irv Kupcinet, Chicago talk show host, his daughter, and Rose Shirami. And so I knew that she was somewhat of a hooker, drug runner, stripper. So I had on a stripper outfit underneath my suit. And I came in, and I did whatever he told me to do, starting off with the doctor and Dorothy Kilgallen. And by the time I took my clothes off and I had on my stripper outfit, I was Rose Shirami. He told me I was on heroin withdrawal and that I was hysterical because of what I knew. And so I started screaming and the tears started streaming down my face. And he said, God, I've never seen anyone do that so fast. And I said, well, I've been studying with Lee Strasberg 25 years, and that's what I do. So he hired me on the spot, and he began to have his people send me, but back then there was no email, so there were fax machines. So every day I got more and more and more faxes on Rose Shirami and Jack Ruby, all this background. And then he made us sign something, a rider in the contract that we wouldn't talk about it. We wouldn't talk about JFK at all until after the film was out. Because he was having death threats and whatnot.
Which is amazing. I mean, this movie was persecuted before it even started shooting in a way that I've never seen before. But were you aware of the kind of the fury in the media about this film when you became involved? Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
So tell me what you discovered about Rose that was of greatest interest to you.
Well, she was a single mom, and she had a son named Michael, and she was just trying to survive, and she did all these things, drug running and strip dancing and I guess being a call girl and working for him however he wanted her to. I'm reading a book now. I don't know if you know about it, but I just started it, called Rose by Many Other Names, Rose Shirami of the JFK Assassination by Todd Elliott.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there is a book out on her. But since I just began, I can't tell you too much. I did see her mugshot, and there's a few words that says her 10-year-old son, Michael, said that there was nothing behind her eyes. I remember I was in makeup, and I had them doing heroin marks up and down my arm, being a method actor, and I suddenly got someone put a telephone next to my ear, and it was Oliver said, "We're all ready. Are you ready?" And so very abruptly, in the middle of getting my heroin makeup, I split, you know, and got in a car and drove to where he was. He shot it in 8, 16, and 35 color and black and white all at once.
Mm.
And he wanted a stunt woman to fall out of the car, and I said, no, I wanted to fall out of the car. And I remember my leg was bleeding, but I felt so authentic.
Yeah.
That's
just it. There is such – what's remarkable about your performance in the movie, well, a couple of things. There is such a level of – I don't know what word to use. Anxiety is too light a word, but you're automatically in that state, and you alluded to it earlier. That kind of performance comes naturally to you, or do you have to work up to that level?
No, I mean, we shot this when did we shoot this? 1990?
91, it would be probably.
91,
yeah.
So I started training with the Actors Studio in 1964. So that's a lot of years of training how to get your rage out and your tears out and your. I have actually a method acting teacher, and so those kind of roles come easy. I don't know if you saw my film Anna that I got nominated for.
Absolutely, yes, ma'am.
So that was similar. You know, there was very little time to shoot, and there was a lot of emotional range, and that's kind of my forte. I think I do that better than anything. It was amazing working with Oliver. He's very intense, as you can imagine, but he wanted to know, like the scene when I come into the hospital room, he wanted to know how I wanted to shoot it to achieve that end. And I said, can we shoot the rehearsal? And he said, sure. And I said, can you not tell your crew that you're going to have me wheeled down the hall of the hospital and into the room? Can it be a surprise? Can I just be hysterical and you're shooting and no one knows what's going on? And he said, sure. And so the actors playing the newsman and the doctor in the room, when I got wheeled in and I was screaming and whatnot, they had no idea. They probably thought it was rehearsal, but we did it in one take, and that's how we did it.
Wow. So you were – another thing that amazes me about your section of the film, it really kicks off the narrative. I mean, it gets right there at the very beginning. So I would imagine you,
you know, that Newsweek magazine – the very opening line of their review said the most authentic moment in the movie was Rose Shirami.
Wow.
That's nice, huh?
It's very nice. But it sets up a very ominous urgent tone in the film, your performance. It just gives so much to it. Were you, I'm sure you're aware of the scope of the film that you were involved in.
Yes. We all were. And like I said, we didn't talk about it. It was like a secret conspiracy of our own. I remember because I was a stripper, I asked him if Oliver and Kevin and I could go to a place that Jack Ruby ran. If it wasn't the place, it was one of the places or whatnot. I don't remember the name of it now. But so we went to the strip club, and I went upstairs and talked to the strippers, and I asked them if they minded if I stripped. And they were kind of surprised, and they said, well, ordinarily they would, but you had to belong to the union. So it was illegal to have anyone come in there and, you know, that wasn't one of their strippers. But I was totally into it. I was going to do Rosh Harami. And I remember Oliver and Kevin, they had a good time with all the dancers circling around the table and falling all over them, you know.
Yeah. Actually, you had worked with Costner before, hadn't you?
Yeah, and Revenge. Yeah. He had something to do with my getting the part. I mean, Oliver was thinking about it and open to it, but, you know, really not knowing how to fit me in. And I sent flowers to both of them, and I think Kevin put in a word. I knew Kevin from way before he was a star. He was a stage manager at the Raleigh Studios when Neil Young directed me in a movie, and now I can't think of the name of it, with me and Dennis Hopper and Dean Stockwell and Human Highway, it was called. And so when I met Kevin for Revenge, I said, oh, my God, I loved you in No Way Out, and I loved you in Field of Dreams, and I loved you in this. And he said, Sally, don't you remember me? And I said, well, you're Kevin Costner. He said, no, I was the stage manager at the Raleigh Studios when you were one of the people that taught me how to act. That, I mean, he was just very gracious. So, yeah, he helped me get into JFK. I remember when it showed at the Academy and that beginning of the film happened, there was this gasp from everybody in the audience. It was very memorable in my life of how that affected the audience.
That's it for this episode of Movie Geeks United. We hope you enjoyed this special look inside the film JFK. For more information on Movie Geeks United and access to our entire library of over 700 filmmaker interviews, you can visit our website at moviegeeksunited.net.